In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with women's weight loss and metabolism expert Louise Digby. Louise and I speak about the link between hormones and weight loss, the impact of toxic load on health, and what muscle loss and metabolism have to do with each other. I hope you enjoy the episode, and please, if you like the show, subscribe and give us a rating, or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Louise. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with women's weight loss coach and metabolism expert Louise Digby. Welcome to the show. I'm excited to speak to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here too.
I look forward to speaking about all things metabolism, all things stubborn belly fat and hunger and everything like that. But I would like to hear a little bit about you before we do. So how did you get to where you are today in terms of your coaching and just in general, your own health?
Yeah, so I think I kind of started off really as a teenager. I had quite a strong interest in nutrition because my mom always had a really strong interest and she really wanted to be a nutritionist. So I was kind of brought up with a good, like, well-rounded understanding of food and how powerful it can be. So it was natural for me to go into studying nutrition. And then when I graduated, I was working with everyone and anyone in terms of whatever problems they had, whatever goals they had, you know, whether it was eczema or IBS or depression or whatever, then we worked on that. But then over time, what I noticed was that pretty much everyone that wanted to address whatever health concerns, whatever chronic condition, they also wanted to lose weight. So I kind of ended up becoming more experienced in that area. And what I really noticed was that it was the people that came to me who were focused on their health, who had the best results, particularly when it came to their weight, as opposed to the people that came to me just wanting to lose weight. They didn't get such good results. And it was usually because they're more focused on restricting their diet and just trying to cut calories in whatever way they can. So that was really interesting to discover. And then I particularly noticed that it was women who were in that mid stage of life around perimenopause and menopause who were working the hardest and seeing the worst results, really, you know, not really making much progress. So really all of that led me down this road to where I am now, really specializing in this area so that I can help women to really address the root cause of this really stubborn weight and all the chaotic symptoms that can come at this time of life.
Yeah, I love it. I can absolutely attest to that from many of the people that come and want to work with us, that especially the women in midlife, that they sometimes seem to be so, so disciplined, excited and focused about on losing the weight, and they have a harder time than anyone else. So how come that is such a big issue? What sort of link is there between our hormones and metabolism?
Absolute massive link. And, you know, really our hormones control everything to do with weight loss, from how fast our metabolism runs to whether we're in fat burning mode or fat storage mode, and also where we store our fats. So the hormones really control everything. And the thing is that your typical diets, the ones that are focused on calorie control or just burning as many calories as possible, they don't do anything to address your hormones. You know, that if anything, hormone imbalances can get worse with those types of approaches. So that's part of the reason why it can be so tricky to lose the weight around this time, because the way that we've been taught to manage our weight just doesn't work. It just doesn't address the actual problem. But everything that we do, whether it's, you know, to do with eating or sleeping or exercise or exposure to toxins or our gut health, all of these things have a knock-on effect on our hormones. So that's kind of the things, those are the things that we need to be thinking about rather than just how much we're eating.
Yeah, so let's get into that. How can we optimize our hormones in order to boost the metabolism? And I'd love to go literally through everything, but I think one thing at a time. So let's start off in terms of nutrition. Like, are there specific foods, specific food groups, or macro distributions that are more helpful for metabolism than others?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's always important to acknowledge that it's different for everyone. There's a huge amount of individual variability because hormone imbalances, they can come in many forms and combinations. So we have to remember that there isn't kind of a one size fits all approach, but there are some foundations that we can get in place to give us a really good starting point. In terms of macro balance, as you brought that up, really, we want to make sure that we're not taking anything to the extreme. So often with diets, they'll be cutting out all your carbs or all your fat, and neither of those things are good. Whilst, it can kind of make sense in a way to cut out carbs because many people know now that blood sugars are very important for weight management and hormone balance. When we take our carbs too low, that has negative effects as well. Even though it helps support our blood sugars, it can have a negative impact on our thyroid. Your thyroid needs carbs and calories to run properly. So when we take that to the extreme, our thyroid tends to slow down, which is why we tend to get a weight loss plateau shortly after starting a very low carb diet or a keto diet, particularly again in this age group of sort of late 30s, 40s, 50s, you're even more prone to your thyroid slowing down as a result of restricting too much. And then going the other way and cutting the fat out isn't a good idea either because we need that fat. We need it to make our hormones. It helps to keep us full. It helps to keep our brain healthy and so many different things. So, really, coming back to everything in moderation, it's a very boring recommendation, but it really is the key because we do need a little bit of everything. Just making sure that we're having plenty of protein is a good starting point. Plenty of fiber in the form of a good variety of plant-based foods, and then some fats as well. That is really a good starting point. In terms of getting, very specific with the grammage of the macros, I don't think it's particularly necessary, not unless you're, an athlete and you need to be super honed in on those things. Otherwise, I think it can cause more stress, than it's worth when we try to be a little bit too focused on measuring things out or counting things. So, yeah, I'd say macro-wise, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, I think you touched on such a good point that people tend to want to go into some extremes, or especially with the low carb diets. Of course, it's really motivating because in the beginning we see such big drops from simply the body also letting go of the water weight and so on. But yeah, the dangers that follow not soon after, they really do need to be acknowledged. And of course, if we're generally as a population, most people are consuming too many refined carbs, too many poor quality fats, and with that, then automatically, most of the time, not enough protein. So I love that you touched on that. And maybe we can get into that a little bit later in more detail. But from my experience, it just really helps with satiation as well. And we know that it's just the macro least likely to be stored as body fat. And then, of course, it helps us with our muscle mass, which we're going to talk about later as well. But yeah, I really like that approach in terms of moderation, in terms of balance. And I mean, whether that exactly means 30% protein or 35 and, 40% carbs or 30% fats or whatever, that is also down to personal preference. And like you said, someone's activity level, if someone is very sedentary, it's different than if someone is highly active and, running and strength training 6 times per week or so. So definitely a good note there. But yeah, let's talk about the specific foods. What are some foods or food groups perhaps that help the metabolism or the thyroid or the liver, whatever is connected there?
Yeah, I think a good place to start is with thinking about foods that can be really supportive of our sex hormone balance, because that's often, I think the sex hormone balance is very delicate and impacted by lots of different things. And there are some foods that do specifically help with the balance of your hormones. So things like cruciferous vegetables, which are like your broccolis, cauliflowers, Brussels sprouts, kales, radishes, they are all really helpful at supporting your liver at detoxing estrogen. And I think this is something that no one ever really thinks about, is that yes, we have hormones, but we also have to eliminate them from the body once we've used them. They kind of become like a waste product once we've used them. And if we don't eliminate them efficiently, then that can cause disruption to our hormones and imbalance. So supporting the detoxification is really helpful, and having cruciferous vegetables regularly can really support that detoxification. And on a similar theme, flax seeds or linseeds are a really great option too, particularly when they're ground down and milled, for lots of reasons, partly because they have phytoestrogens in them, which can help to modulate your hormone balance, but also they help to bind up toxins and estrogens in the gut and carry them out of your gut, and also keep your bowels moving regularly. And having regular bowel movements is again key to supporting your hormones, so that we are eliminating them properly and not at risk of reabsorbing them after we've gone through that lengthy process of detoxing them, which is, something that can happen quite often. So those are two really like functional foods when it comes to the sex hormones. In terms of, I think, just supporting hormones generally, making sure that we've got plenty of omega-3s in the diet is key as well. So this could be from oily fish. That's generally going to be your best source, but also things, again, like flax seeds, walnuts and hemp seeds, chia seeds. These can be good sources as well. So making sure that we have those in the diet is important, because we use them to make our hormones, but also they're very anti-inflammatory, and inflammation is, something that can be quite disruptive to your hormones too. So yeah, omega-3s are key as well. Just trying to think if anything else jumps out at me. I mean, protein generally, again, just protein as a whole, really great for supporting hormones in every way, really, from keeping your blood sugars balanced to helping you make your hormones, to keeping you fuller for longer, so you're less likely to eat sugars and refined carbs that can be disruptive to your blood sugars and therefore your insulin and blood sugar hormones. So yeah, protein is always one of the first things to think about.
Great. Yeah, I love how you also said it's not just important to balance out our hormone production, but to also make sure we're eliminating the used hormones properly, or if we have an excess in certain hormones. And I think that's a pretty prevalent, important topic to think about, not just if we produce too much of something ourselves, but also because of the topic we're going to talk about soon here in a minute, and that is the toxic load. So things that have the ability to mimic our hormones and dock onto the hormone receptors, and then the actual hormones that we have just kind of keep circulating in the bloodstream, and then that leads to normally estrogen excess, or that's at least from my knowledge, the most common one most of the time. But yeah, maybe you can explain to us the impact of toxic load on just in general metabolism or health and weight.
Yeah, this is such an important conversation, because it's something that isn't talked about enough, and it has such a big impact on our hormones. So we are exposed to toxins constantly, things like pollution, pesticides, parabens and phthalates from skincare products and fragrances, to cleaning products and chemicals that are on like flame retardant coatings on sofas and carpets and all these things, many, many different things that we're exposed to. And, our body has to process those and eliminate them. And whilst our liver is always detoxing and it is there to do that job, in kind of today's world where we are exposed to so much stuff that our body has to detox. You know, there's quite a high toxic load and your liver's having to work quite hard. And when you have that high toxic load, that can have an impact on your hormones because essentially those toxins are competing to be detoxed with your hormones. So if we've got a lot of toxins to detox, then essentially those hormones can be recirculated around the body rather than being detoxed and eliminated efficiently. Which can cause imbalance, but also the toxins can be recirculated as well. And the toxins themselves, many of them are known as hormone disruptors or xenoestrogens, and that's because they are very similar in their chemical structure to our own estrogens. And that can be a problem because they can essentially get in the way of our estrogen doing its job. They can kind of bind to our receptors on our cells and block estrogen from doing what they need to do, or they can act as very potent estrogens and cause like an estrogen dominance type effect. So making sure that we are limiting our exposure to these where possible, as well as supporting our body in detoxing and eliminating these hormone disruptors, can be really helpful for supporting your sex hormone balance, which has a knock-on effect on your metabolism and all the other balance of the other hormones as well.
Yeah, I think a really, really, really important point that's often overlooked. I mean, yes, of course, you and I both know when it comes to weight loss, calories are king. Movement is so important and helpful for that energy balance and so on. But then sometimes, if we're just completely overloading our entire system with a hormone imbalance, and in that way, through our we're not even aware of it through that toxic load, that can really, really put a handbrake on things. So, what are some practical things people can do? Like, let's say, I mean, you mentioned several things. You mentioned parabens, you mentioned pesticides, you mentioned plastic and all these things. So yeah, what are some practical steps someone can do to say, like, okay, I don't know if I have a high toxic load, but I really want to make sure that I am minimizing things as best as possible.
A good place to start is with plastics because they're usually quite easy to swap out. So if you're using a plastic water bottle, switch to glass or aluminium. Same for like food storage containers, try to avoid using plastic ones and swap to glass, which is super handy because you can cook in them as well. So you get a whole load of extra cooking pots or whatever, baking tray type things when you swap over to glass. So that's a quite easy swap and just something that you do one time and you don't have to think about it again, really. And equally, you know, trying to avoid reheating food in plastic, even if you don't have the budget to replace all of your Tupperware with glass food containers, you know, just avoiding heating food up in plastic can help as well. So that's plastics. And then in terms of things like pollution, you know, you're always a little bit limited on what you can do, but things like air purifiers, particularly if you live on a main road or in a city, then it's a good idea to get some air purifiers about the house, particularly in the rooms that you spend the most time in. And also, houseplants are really good at purifying the air. Some plants in particular, like snake plants and aloe vera, are really good at kind of taking the pollution out of the air and replacing it with oxygen. So, houseplants can be really powerful. And then looking at your skincare and swapping over to kind of cleaner organic skincare is probably something that's a bit more of a gradual process as things run out, start looking for kind of alternatives. It's not always easy to kind of find products that you're confident are kind of clean, natural products. More and more products over here are listing that something is like sulfate free, paraben free, phthalate free. So you can start to see it on the labels of some products. But what you want to do is kind of look for things that might be organic, look for companies that are based around being cleaner, because then you're going to be a little bit more confident that they are going to be clean. And then cleaning products, you know, there's lots of alternatives out there now for kind of more natural cleaning products. But equally, it's very easy to make your own and use things like baking soda and vinegar, which can be, you know, just as powerful as some of the stronger things that we find in the shops. So switching those things over can make a really big difference to what you're exposed to.
Yeah, I like that you said it's a gradual process because sometimes when people hear this at first, they're like, "What? I like just bought new makeup or a face wash for $50 like a week ago. I don't want to throw that out." And it's like, "Hey, you know, have self-compassion. It's all good. You can use that up if you're happy with that. Unless someone has like a burning desire to get pregnant as soon as possible or is like really suffering from menopausal symptoms. In most cases, I would just say like, hey, let's take it one thing at a time." So yeah, absolutely. Because otherwise, you are gonna be short several hundred, if not, you know, $1,000 if you're exchanging your entire cookware and everything else as well. But yeah, thankfully there are more and more brands that are like clearly stating paraben free and so on. But I would always say that like if you are just using a conventional brand, it's probably safe to assume that they're not paraben free or that they unfortunately yeah. So the last one which I wanted to touch on that you mentioned was pesticides, because I do think often it's difficult for people to decipher, do I need to buy everything or thing organic? I already am struggling with my budget. Like, how do I make that work with my desire to lower my endocrine mimicking chemical exposure?
And there's definitely kind of ways that you can do it on a budget. So there's a list called the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen, and these are a list of particularly fruits and vegetables that are either particularly dirty in terms of have a very high pesticide load, or clean and you don't necessarily need to buy them organic. So having that list handy is really helpful because, you know, you can save money on the clean foods, and then the foods that are on that dirty dozen, those are the ones to prioritize buying organic or avoiding if, you know, budget really doesn't permit. And then if you eat animal products and dairy products, then it's a good idea to opt for organic for those if you can. But if you don't have the budget, then either reducing your meat intake is a good idea, or opting for leaner cuts of meats, because unfortunately the toxins are stored in fat. So if we're having fattier cuts of meat, then we're going to be exposed to more toxins. If you're having free range, organic, pasture fed or grass fed, then, you know, fatty cuts of meat, in my opinion, are great because they're super nutritious. But unfortunately, if the quality of the meat isn't so good, then it's best to go for leaner cuts of meat. And another thing that I want to mention is tofu. If you're buying tofu or any soya products, go for organic because that has a really high pesticide load and a particularly nasty pesticide called glyphosate. So yeah, hopefully those tips will help anyone trying to eat more organic.
Yeah, I think that's a great point on the soy because sometimes people think it's soy in and of itself that messes with the estrogen, and that's really not the case there. We do know by now that there are lots and lots of health benefits also to be had from soy products or great micronutrients potentially. But like you said, it is usually the pesticide load that can mess with our hormones and on that end. But yeah, something else I want to touch on that you mentioned earlier in regards to metabolism and how that affects also. So blood sugar control, and that is the amount of muscle that we have. So how are our metabolism and our muscle mass linked in that sense?
Yeah, they're directly linked. So basically, it's our muscle that is metabolically active. It's our muscle that burns calories. So the more muscle we have, the higher our metabolic rate. And, you know, as we get older, particularly after the age of 35, we start gradually losing muscle, and that tends to correlate with the decline of estrogen. Estrogen, you know, helps us to maintain our muscle. So we kind of have this natural drop off of metabolism if we're not taking steps to maintain our muscle mass. And the pervasive message is that as you get older, your metabolism declines, and it's normal to gain weight. But actually, if you take steps to maintain your muscle mass, then there's no reason why your metabolism should drop off dramatically. And you don't need to eat less to maintain your weight. Actually, we need to flip the approach and focus on building strength. And the more muscle you have, the more you can eat.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And of course, who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want to be able to eat more? While also, I think for me, the main benefit or the big benefit is also, you're shaping your body. It's not just because sometimes when people lose weight, they just look like a deflated kind of boat or whatever, like skinny fat type of thing. And that's in some horrible cases, they even have a higher body fat percentage after losing weight because they lost so much lean weight. And so that is, of course, something we want to avoid. So I love that you're mentioning or highlighting the importance of protein, the importance of exercise in that, and with the connection to metabolism directly there. So yeah, really, really good point. I will make sure to link the Reignite Your Metabolism ebook in the show notes so people can go and grab that because I think everybody wants to reignite or improve their metabolism. And thank you so much for providing a discount code for us as well. So listeners, if you use the code FRANZ, so my surname, FRANZ, you will be able to get 50% off on that. Thank you so much, Louise. But yeah, I want to kind of finish with a few more questions regarding more like the mindset around food, because you provide such great content on your Instagram as well when it comes to that. So, for example, when it comes to emotional eating, so even like anybody who's on a health journey, a weight loss journey, or has any kind of yeah, I guess health ambitions, we all have slip ups. Well, nobody is perfect. We all have days where we're like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have eaten that, or we have a hard day at work or something that bugged us about a conversation we had. And unfortunately, food is such an easy dopamine hit. So we sometimes turn to that. And I think what most people battle with afterwards is guilty conscience, or you just feel horrible in your body as well. So how do we go about those sort of times where we have emotional eating episodes? How can we prevent them? But also, how can we deal with the guilt around quote unquote slip ups?
Yeah, and I think it's important to realize that the guilt doesn't serve you in any way. When we feel, there's been research on this, and when we feel guilty about something, particularly food related, we're more likely to go ahead and eat more of it to kind of soothe ourselves and kind of make ourselves feel better in that moment. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle. So I think it really takes practice and just practicing having some compassion for yourself and acknowledging that, maybe you slipped up, or I never really feel like there's a good way of talking about this, because I think all these different kind of labels have negative connotations. But let's say that you've slipped up, and just acknowledging it, kind of thinking about why it happened. Was it that you just had a, not enough organization, not enough prep, so you didn't have anything in the fridge ready to eat? Or maybe it was that you didn't sleep well last night. And I look at what are the triggers, and then just basically try and forget about it, try and move on, because if you dwell on it, then it's just not going to achieve anything. So practice some compassion. Think about what you would do if it was, someone you loved, a child. You'd probably just say, oh well, doesn't matter, like, let's just think about, onwards and upwards. So you've just got to practice doing that with yourself. And I had someone on my podcast a while ago who I thought had some really great advice around this. And it's funny because it never really dawned on me, but when we are trying to eat better, when we're trying to kind of implement new habits, we we might set ourselves the task of doing something 2 or 3 times a week. But when it comes to working on our mindsets, we kind of just expect ourselves to be better immediately. But what she recommended was perhaps just having, half a day a week or a couple of half days a week where we're really mindful around our food or the language that we use around food, and just, try and practice that kind of more compassionate way of thinking and speaking to ourselves, and trying not to label foods as good or bad, and just look at food as fuel, and, try not to berate ourselves and all that sort of thing. So I think just kind of like earmarking some time in your diary to just be a bit more mindful, and then practicing that and gradually scaling up can be a nice way to start.
Yeah, cool. I like the that you mentioned both tips. So you said number one, reflecting on why that's happened. I think that is an important step because some people they do just think, oh, I just need to move on, just need to move on. But then they brush over the fact that maybe it happens every Thursday and they forget or they miss that opportunity to work on preventing that the next Thursday. But they're just like, oh no, Lisa said, just move on, get back on the track the next day and forget about it. But if we just do that, we're always going to keep repeating the pattern. And likewise, if we only reflect but we don't move on, we continue to feel guilty, and it might turn into an even longer quote unquote binge or whatever, because we're already thinking, oh, I'm off the track now. So what's the point of simply getting back to it? So yeah, I like both steps there. And I actually really like what you mentioned, your podcast guest shared about just reserving specific time to practice that more and more. And maybe if you reserve 2 afternoons the first week, maybe then in 2, 3 weeks' time, you reserve 3 afternoons where you really want to be mindful about things. Another great thing that I heard not too long ago on a podcast, and I really liked that. I've been implementing it with a few things that I'm working on. And that was he called it the 7 by 7 by 7 method, I think. So basically, you pick 7 things that you want to work on. It can be like a financial goal, it can be a physical goal, it can be like anything like that. So let's just say mindful eating or eating more slowly. I want to save up so and so much money per week, and something, 7 things, or it can be 4 things, I don't know. But he said 7, and you want to write them out, and you do that for 7 days, 7 times a day. So essentially, that requires you to remember your goals 7 times in that day for 7 days. And it's actually harder than one might think to do that because, of course, you don't just want to sit down in the morning and write it out 7 times. That's not the point of it. The point of it is that throughout the day, you're reminded of your goal, of where we get sidetracked, where we think of all our to-do lists and then blah, blah, blah. And but before you know it, the day is over and you've completely forgotten what your goal actually was. But if you have to pause and stop, and maybe you set yourself a reminder every 2 hours to write down that one line of the 7 goals for 7 days, after 7 days, it's almost gonna be like there already, and you might even feel like you want to continue with that list. I really like that method actually. So anyone listening, I encourage you to do that with your goals.
It's almost like conditioning yourself, isn't it? And like reconditioning your subconscious. And the more
Precisely.
you repeat it and kind of practice remembering it, then the more it's going to be front of mind, and you're probably going to be more likely for your behaviors to align with what you want to achieve.
Exactly. No, that's 100% it. Yes. Well, speaking of behaviors, the last question I have for you is in regards to something that you spoke about on your social media not too long ago, and that was about screen time and hunger and how they can often be linked. Yeah, talk to us about that because I think everyone is interested in hearing, okay, can my screen time potentially manipulate my hunger, good or bad way?
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's a few ways that it can. We know that blue light that comes from devices, that can actually disrupt your melatonin, which is your sleepy hormone, but it can also raise your blood sugars. Which, when our blood sugars increase, that raises our insulin. Insulin is a fat storage hormone, so it can basically take us out of fat burning mode, even if we've done like everything right throughout the day. if we're having, a lot of exposure to blue light, it could raise our blood sugars and be disruptive in that way. So that's one way. And then also, when it comes to like the dopamine hits that we get from when we're scrolling, or it could be even shopping on our phone, whatever it is that we're kind of doing habitually on those screens, that can give us dopamine hits. And dopamine is very tied in with like the reward system in our body, and it can make us crave rewards, which could be in the form of food, in order to try and get that dopamine hit, because the more dopamine hits we get, the more we want, and the harder it is to get it. So your brain will start kind of looking for other ways to get those dopamine hits. And so cravings for sugar, or kind of those foods that are that 50-50 balance of sugar and fat, give us a real dopamine hit. So we're probably more likely to crave processed foods as well.
Yeah, really good point for sure. And I think anybody who's ever watched a good commercial on food or so also knows that even just like seeing or like when they almost make you feel like you're smelling whatever's on there. And nowadays we can get that any second by going on social media. I don't know what your news feed or your feed looks like on there, but some people have like food porn all over.
Yeah.
And that certainly is not a good idea. And you're like, oh, I should go and check out that restaurant. Oh, I should go and check out that new candy bar that's seasonal and only available for the next week. I really need to go right now. Even though you weren't even hungry beforehand, I think that's quite dangerous. And also, I've
Yeah.
seen just in general, if people like, don't get me wrong, I love a good food documentary, a good food blog or reel or recipe, like the next person. But I think when it gets to like an obsessive point, it can also, like, if someone's really, really been dieting for a very long time and they're restricting themselves a lot, I've seen that some people get so hyper focused on watching food stuff because they're not allowing it themselves. And then on the flip side, of course, if we're just watching it all the time and we want to eat more and more, but I think it is something to be auditing our social media with as well. Like, how much of that do I actually need? How many of the recipes that I'm saving do I actually ever make? Is it just something that's like continuing to be more prevalent on my mind for no good reason? Or then we also get more gravitated towards, oh, this person did the carnivore diet and had success with that. Maybe I need to try that. Or this person just went vegan and maybe I need to try that. So I think putting on the blinders and just staying in your own lane for that, and like knowing, hey, my breakfast and my lunch works perfectly for me. I don't need 50 other suggestions to look at on a daily basis to just distract me from what I'm doing.
Yeah, and I think that absolute bombardment of information and ideas and recipes and possibilities, it can almost keep us stuck, because there's so many possibilities that, it can be very difficult to commit to one thing or doing something in one way. Sometimes I have clients who are, they're, like you say, almost obsessed. And they're looking at they're constantly reading articles, listening to podcasts, watching documentaries, scrolling recipes, reading blogs, and they're constantly coming to me with like, oh, what about this? What about this? What about this? It's like, well, what if we just stopped and we just followed through with the original plan, and we got rid of all that noise, and your nervous system would probably calm down a lot. And it's often these kind of type A personalities, people that are quite anxious and trying to like micromanage everything that's going on. They're often the people that can have the slowest progress, because the system is like wired all the time. And I think, like you say, tuning out some of that stuff, getting rid of some of that noise, can be really, really helpful, particularly if you are someone who has, struggled with disordered eating at points. It's very easy to fall back into that. And whilst the content that you're consuming could be, very positive and healthy, just the sheer amount of it can lead you back down to being very fixated on this one part of your life rather than having a better balance across hobbies and all sorts of
Oh
things.
yes, no, honestly, you're preaching it, and I think in the end that is probably your and my mission, right? To get people to live a happier, healthier life. But sometimes people forget about the living aspect, and they're just so like food becomes the whole thing, and that's definitely not what you want. So dropping that stress, like you're saying, is such a good point. And I think on top of that, if you're too like, here's the next shiny object, here's the next little diet and next little recipe, it messes with the consistency and being consistent with the plan, everything. I mean, that is the only a recipe, pun intended, to get to where people want to get to. So, yeah, Louise, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you and hearing all the ins and outs of our metabolism. And I hope people go and grab your Reignite Your Metabolism ebook. It certainly sounds like there's a lot of value in there. So, truly, thank you for your time and for sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been really great chatting with you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Louise. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.